He shut her door and handed me the keys. "Drive carefully," he said. "I will," I promised. He gave me a stiff nod and strode over to Adam's SUV. I didn't have to adjust the seat to be comfortable. Thomas wasn't very big to be that scary. I took a moment to familiarize myself with the car so I wouldn't have to do it while I was driving. "Thank you," Margaret said. I gave her a startled look, because as a rule the Fae don't thank you, and you'd better not thank them either. Thank you implies debt, and most Fae will hold you to that. Margaret laughed. "I'm not that old, Mercy," she said. "About 100 years, and most of that was spent in the heart of the hill, underground, imprisoned in a forgotten chunk of mine tunnel." She'd said that she'd had no food, no drink, no light. I tried to imagine what going without food and water for almost 100 years would have been like. A werewolf would have died, starved to death like a human in that situation, maybe even faster than a human. There were degrees of immortality, some more terrible than others. Unaware of my thoughts, Margaret had kept talking. "My father thought that it was important that we blend with the normal folk, so I don't have a lot of the taboos the old Fae do. Thank you means just what it would to you." Adam's SUV lit up, and I rolled down the window to wave them ahead. I didn't spend much time in Walla Walla. If I'd been alone, I could have found my way out to the highway, but why bother when Adam could lead the way? He flashed his lights and took point. "How did you survive?" I asked her. "Not very well." She held her hand up and moved it. "It's taken me years to get this far, and the first year I spent as a total bedridden invalid. But I am better now, getting better almost every day. A month ago, I would not have been able to stay on my feet as long as I did tonight." She paused. "That's sort of what I wanted to talk to you about. You are human."
"Half," I said apologetically. "My father is not human." I wasn't up to explaining my complicated parentage to her, likable as I found her. Besides, I was pretty sure my bloodlines weren't what she wanted to talk about. "I can change into a coyote, and I have a few other tricks up my sleeve."
"But your husband is still far stronger than you," she said. I nodded.
"He is."
"How did you get him to stop treating you like a fragile thing that might blow away in a harsh wind and take you to bed?" she said.
Holy cow, the girlfriend talk. I tried to remember the last time I'd done the girlfriend talk. Shar. It had been with Shar, when I'd talked her out of the very handsome but not very bright young man who would make a lovely date for someone else. That was all the way back in college. I smelled Margaret's sudden embarrassment.
"I had a much more tactful way to ask that," she said. Then she let out a frustrated growl. "We've been living together for 2.5 years, and the most passion I get is a kiss on the forehead, and I don't have anyone but Thomas to ask about it, and I can't ask Thomas."
"Obviously not," I said. The reason I hadn't had the girlfriend talk with anyone in a long time is that I sucked at it. I could barely talk to Adam about our relationship, and I loved Adam.
"Right," she said. I liked Margaret. I wanted to help her if I could, even if only as a sounding board. But I couldn't forget what Margaret was. Despite the easy way she'd thanked me and how she just established that she was not under the power of the Grey Lords, she was still Fae. If there was one thing I'd learned about the Fae, it was that being in their debt was only a little more dangerous than having a Fae in my debt. If she wanted my help, I'd ask for her help, too. "I have a proposition for you," I said. "I'll try to help you, as much as one clueless person can help another, if you'll give me some intelligence on the people in the room tonight." Like, say, the name of the middle-aged woman in Salmon who had tortured Z. I could ask Z, but he tends to hate everyone uniformly. It hadn't been an accident that Tad had been the one to talk to Adam and me about the Widow Queen. I could call Ariana, maybe, but she was in Europe, and she hadn't been in that room tonight.
"Deal," she said promptly. "What do you want to know?"
"Don't you think I should go first?" I asked.
I see your problem, but I'm relationship challenged. Since Thomas sounds like he's relationship challenged too, you might be better off talking to Adam, who has experience dealing with stupid people. She leaned back in her seat and smiled sweetly. Unlike when Z smiled sweetly, it didn't send the hairs on the back of my neck up with nervousness. I'm not in the inner circle of the council either. All I know is the stuff my father drilled into my head, but he was pretty sharp. I have to tell you that if all you do is listen to me whine, it would help me a great deal. Let's do politics first. I have a feeling it will be less depressing. What do you want to know? Let's start with the woman in the salmon-colored suit, I said. Orla, she said. She is the sister of Brian McKennetig. I frowned, because she said the name of Orla's brother as if I should have known him. Who? I asked. He was the High King of Ireland, she said. He defeated the kings of Ulster. I only knew one of the High Kings of Ireland named Brian. Okay, I only knew the name of one of the High Kings of Ireland, and his name was Brian. Do you mean Brian Boru? I asked tentatively. The one who united all of the Irish against the Vikings? She let out a huff of air. And a good thing it is that my father died before he heard you say that. Boru is a nickname given him years after he died by people who didn't know him. And the Vikings weren't driven out. They were assimilated. Not that it is important to our current conversation. Not being an expert on Irish history, I didn't feel the need to argue. Okay, so Brian Boru was fey? No. His father married a fey lady who saw to it that he thought her daughter Orla was his. She soon grew bored of him and went on her way, but she left her daughter behind. Margaret huffed. But that's not what you need to know, is it? Still, despite her chosen appearance, Orla is very young for a Grey Lord. Even so, my father said she is too tied to the glories of the past. Her greatest strength is in her ability to persuade people to follow her. My father liked her a great deal. I think she tortured Z, I said. I don't think I'm going to like her. She smiled, but it was a sad smile. My father did not like your Z. The Dark Smith was not, even by the flexible standards of the Fae, a hero. I knew that. I knew that. But I'd worked side by side with him for most of my adult life. I'd seen him do a lot of small kindnesses, and I suspected that there were some I'd missed because he was embarrassed by them. He was not petty, and I'd never seen him be cruel. I decided it would be safer to change the subject. So the Widow Queen? Newth? Margaret focused her gaze on the dark beyond the windows of the Subaru. She's not a nice person. Dangerous. She takes pleasure in the misery of others. She despises humankind. Despises those weaker than her, and most people are weaker than she is. That dovetailed with what Tad had said about her. Garau, I said. She looked at me. My father didn't know him well. Garau didn't take an active role among the Fae until after my father died. Much of what I know of him comes from the research Thomas did for this trip. She smiled as if at some memory. The vampires follow Fae politics for entertainment. Thomas gathered a lot more information about Curran politics than the Grey Lords would be comfortable with if they knew. She tapped a finger on the dash. So, Garau, King Arthur wasn't a king, really, and the stories of the Knights of the Round Table are only very loosely factual. But Arthur was a hero, and Garau rode with him. He killed a giant. The troll you killed was but a rabbit to the wolf that a giant would have been. She paused. But that was a long time ago. Garau has done nothing important since, except for his selection into the Council of the Grey Lords. I wouldn't have thought one of Arthur's men would have stooped to the foulness of those slave bracelets. She hummed a little. It was on key and pretty. I also wouldn't have thought a Grey Lord would have been so easily defeated. Nemaine. Her name seemed to hang in the air longer than sound should have. Suddenly, it was very dark in the car, the dash lights only a candle in the night. The Carrion Crow, Margaret said slowly. and for the first time I smelled fear rising from her skin. One of the three Fae who could be Morrigan, the goddess of battle. She is smart and very old, and very, very clever. My father respected her, and feared her. The only one of the Fae he truly feared. She is capable of playing a very long game. She is patient, Margaret swallowed, and bloodthirsty. Maybe if we hadn't been in a dark car driving through the dark, her words wouldn't have been so frightening. Like how a story told by firelight has more power than one told in the light of day. But I hadn't been afraid of her back in the hotel. Newth, yes, but not Nemaine. I could just be affected by Margaret's fear, but it felt like more than that. Maybe it was just that we spoke of someone who was a power, and who had been a power for longer than I could imagine, and we spoke of her in the loneliness of the night. Okay, I said, now that you've scared us both. I had the sudden conviction that Adam and I were in way over our heads. We had just met with five of the Grey Lords, but those weren't the only Grey Lords on that reservation. When I saw her sitting there, Margaret said, I was very grateful for Thomas at my back. There was still one we hadn't spoken of. Beauclerc, I said. I knew him best of the Grey Lords, and liked what I knew. She smiled and relaxed. My father said that Lou's son likes to be underestimated. It helps him that so many of the Fae remember his father, Lou, and judge the son from that scale. Lou was everything they say he was. Sometimes the humans called him a god, and they weren't far wrong. She didn't exactly stiffen, but she eyed me. He was good, glorious, and kind, and your dark smith killed him. I knew that. Z had killed him because Lou had, like many very old creatures, started to become a monster. It was why Z and Beauclerc did not deal well together, and another reason I'd been surprised when he helped Z escape. Beauclerc and Nemaine are allies, she said. I picked that up from tonight's meeting. From what happened when Adam spoke, I think that those two have a use for you and your pack. Z distracted Orla and Newth. Garau was still recovering from the slave bracelet, but Nemaine and Beauclerc could have responded to Adam when he spoke. By not doing so, they gave legitimacy to Adam's claim. Unless they rule against it out loud, all of Faerie must respect the borders of your territory. That tells me that Adam's claim played right into whatever those two have planned. Okay, I said. Being part of any Fae's plans wasn't a good thing. I'd have to warn Adam. And speaking of warning, you should know that Edith didn't have any trouble seeing through your glamour. Margaret frowned. Edith? There were two guards the Grey Lords brought with them, I said. She was the one that looked like a girl. They weren't guards, she said. The Grey Lords don't use guards. They were servants, to be sent to fetch food or whatever else was required. She frowned. She saw through the glamour. I nodded. There are some who see truth, Margaret said, but it is a rare gift. It may be that gift was the reason they brought her to the meeting. Interesting that she didn't speak when she saw who accompanied us. I'm not a threat, I said, and I'm the only one she looked at. Okay, she said. She dusted her hands on her thighs and took a deep breath. So, tell me how you got an alpha werewolf to treat you like a partner instead of a princess who needs protecting. I pursed my lips. I can tell you that, but I don't think it will be useful in your situation. By the time I'd met Adam, I'd spent my whole life proving myself, Margaret. I knew who I was and what I could do, and I didn't let anyone make me less. Damn it, she said. I hope that you could give me some useful advice. I don't know many women, have never known many women, and your situation seemed so similar. It hadn't been really. Not the beginning of Adam and me, but... A couple of months ago, this volcano god, a great Manitou, came after Adam's ex-wife, I told her. We defeated him, but in the process I was badly injured, Our pack doctor told Adam I was going to die.
Well, she didn't, said Margaret.
I drew in a breath. I was dying, no question. Only by the weirdest circumstances ever did I survive. Not quite dumb luck, but unexpected enough that it was worse, really.
Coyote counted his weird circumstances, and he was unpredictable.
It took a while for me to recover completely. Adam, who has been very, very good about not indulging his wolf's need to be overprotective, has had to deal with his perceived failure to protect me. Sometimes he wakes up in the middle of the night to listen to me breathe. I didn't tell her about the nightmares, or the times when he pulled me close to him to listen to my heart, and his skin was damp with the sweat of fear. Or that sometimes in the darkness of our room, he cried. Those moments weren't for public consumption. But Thomas didn't fail to keep you safe, so the situation isn't completely analogous. Margaret said nothing, but I felt like she was going to, so I kept quiet.
That is, she said, I think very much what is between Thomas and me.
She paused. I don't talk about him to other people. He wouldn't like it. But I need advice, and I don't know how I'm going to get it without giving you the whole picture.
I didn't say anything.
Excuse me, she said. She took out her cell phone and began texting. The phone chimed as her message was returned. She texted back and forth a bit more.
He says I should talk to you, she said.
He was obviously Thomas.
He says Adam says that you are a deep well, that secrets are safe in your keeping.
She gave me a considering look.
That's me, I said, damp. Also, cold and dank.
She laughed. All right. She quit laughing and looked out into the darkness.
I met Thomas when I was 13 in Butte, Montana. Butte was not what it is now, small and forgotten. Gold, then silver, and finally copper, which in the age where all the cities of the world were stringing copper wire for electricity, meant money, and money is power. The people who flocked to the boom town were not just human. My father came, hoping to set up a new court, I think. But his people weren't the only fae, and there was conflict.
She hummed a little, reached out and turned on the radio. Classical music filled the car, replaced by country, and then 80s rock, before she turned it off.
My father's enemies used me against him. They stole me away and chained me in the mining tunnels.
Her restless fingers played with the fabric of her slacks.
The mining tunnels in Butte were 5,000 feet below the earth and more, a mile deep. My father and I, our power comes from the sun.
Silence stretched.
Which is ironic, given that you love a vampire, I said, trying to help her.
Not as ironic as you might think. She played a little more with her slacks.
So you were trapped there for decades?
She shook her head, gave me a quick smile, then went back to her narrative.
Not that time. For a couple of days only. But it gave my father's enemies the idea for what they did to me later. It was still dark and frightening. I was hungry and alone, and I heard a sound.
She swallowed.
I don't have any friends, she said, except for Thomas. I don't quite know how to go about this.
She didn't know me, and it was hard to tell someone you don't know about private things.
My foster parents both died when I was 14, I told her, breaking the awkward silence. Then I realized that was the wrong part of the story to start with.
Let me backtrack. My mother was a buckle bunny when she was 16.
Buckle bunny?
I nodded. That means she followed the rodeo and slept with rodeo cowboys. I guess her parents were a real freak show.
She left home when she was 15 or 16. She took the truck and horse trailer she'd paid for and her quarter horse mare and hit the road. Traveled wherever there was a rodeo and barrel raced. She was good enough she made money at it. But she was lonely, so she chased after the cowboys.
I paused. Rodeo cowboys aren't universally horrible, but they are macho, and some of them, usually not the more successful, are brutal with their animals and with women. She had hooked up with this bronc rider in Wyoming, and he got drunk and pretty rough one night, They'd been sleeping in his horse trailer.
In a horse trailer? Margaret asked.
Some of them have campers in the front, I said. I guess his did. Anyway, the fight spilled to the outside and attracted attention. My mother is a lot shorter than me. She was 16, and he was 28 and big for a bronc rider. He outweighed her by 100 pounds or more. He was snake mean when he was drunk, and the other rodeo riders were afraid of him.
It had been a long time since I told this story to anyone. Even knowing what I knew about my father now, it was still pretty cool. But my mom was nobody's punching bag, and she doesn't believe in fighting fair. She kicked his butt in front of his friends. Then she turned around to get her stuff out of his trailer, and he got to his feet and came after her while her back was turned. I could see by the tension in Margaret's shoulders that the story was getting to her. There was this Native American, a Blackfeet man from Montana, which he sort of had been and sort of hadn't been. He rode bulls, Mom said, and those bull riders are all a little crazy to do what they do. Anyway, he cold-cocked that man before he got close to my mother again. I smiled as I got to the best part. And my mom punched him in the stomach. She said, "I have a gun, you stupid son of a bitch. I could have shot him, and no one would have said it was anything but self-defense. Now he's going to get to beat up some other woman, and it will be your fault." Margaret laughed. "I know, right?" I said. "Mom is scary. Even Adam walked softly around her. She and that bull rider hooked up for a couple of months. Then one day, he just didn't come home. Died in a car wreck. He'd been hunting vampires, and they'd caught up with him. Mom was pregnant with me. Imagine her surprise when she came in to change my diapers and found a coyote puppy in my crib." It was my turn to be quiet for a little while. "She eventually ran down a pack of werewolves. Do you know who the Maroc is?" Margaret nodded. "Right," I said. "That's whose pack she found. He agreed to take me, but she couldn't come with. She decided that it was the best place for me." Mom never said exactly what had made her decide to do that, but I figured it was pretty bad, considering the story she did tell me. I did know that she'd negotiated for visitation rights over Bran's objections. So I was raised by a pretty neat couple. She was human, and he was werewolf. She died, and he committed suicide to be with her. I was 14, and I didn't want to live with anyone else, so Bran let me live on my own. Bran was from an age when 14 was an adult. I was raised a coyote in a werewolf pack. I know exactly what it feels like not to have anyone to talk to. Tell me as much or as little as you'd like. I won't swear not to tell Adam. He's my mate. But if I'm a well, he's a bottomless pit. I glanced at Margaret, then looked back at the road. When we last left you, you were alone, chained in the dark, and hearing monsters. Thomas found me there, Margaret said, but she sounded more comfortable. Good. I'd worried that the monster talk would throw her. If so, she didn't stand a chance taking on someone as closed as Thomas. He reminded me of my foster brother Charles, and for Charles, it had taken an Omega wolf with a backbone of titanium to learn how to make a relationship work. Omega wolves didn't come around very often. Maybe a fairy princess would do. He was a very, very angry man. I asked for his help. He refused. I asked him what he wanted, and he said, no, that's not right. He wanted. I felt what he wanted as if it were water, and he doused me in it so I could feel his need in my bones. But what he asked for was to feed from me. There was a long moment as she weighed what had happened with how much she wanted to tell me. She smiled. I was frightened, but not so frightened I didn't see the hurt that caused his anger. I didn't think he'd be happy to know how easy it was for me to see. She took a breath. I gave him what he wanted, as well as what he asked for, even though he'd done that last because he knew I'd refuse, that I'd give him an excuse to walk off. If I'd known him then as well as I do now, I'd have known there was no way he'd have left me. I'm not sure Thomas knows that. She gave me an incredulous look. Talking. Who would have thought talking to someone would be so useful?
I bet he too needs to know that he would not have left me there. Oh, I knew that battle. Good luck, I said. When your man is responsible for the world, heaven forbid they aren't guilty of every little thing. She giggled, looked at me, and broke down in whoops of amusement. Isn't that the truth now? She said when she quieted, wiping her eyes. She laughed again and shook her head. Anyway, we struck a bargain that night, but it was more than either of us expected. There is magic in bargaining with one of my kind that has nothing to do with what I had the power to do or not do. There, that's some repayment for you. That's why so many of the Fae are willing to strike odd bargains. They can gain power from it. And mine wasn't the only bargain present that night. Thomas's father had bargained with the master vampire who made him. Two bargains in the heart of the hill. There is power in the deep places of the earth, Mercy. There was also my fire magic, tempered to a stronger force by my royal birth, and his... She hesitated. Some things are his secrets to give. But there is magic in Thomas's heritage, too. I gave him three gifts. His freedom from the vampire who had bound him. That was Thomas's own power made manifest. From my magic, I... She sucked in a breath. You are easy to talk to. I think that is something else that belongs to Thomas. I nodded. I can live with that. It was the truth, but I was very curious anyway. She laughed. That was almost a lie. She looked at me. I tell you what. I'll tell Thomas what we talked about, and he can tell you if he chooses. I can live with that better, I said, or at least it isn't any worse. But then I got an inkling. A terrible, horrible, very, very scary inkling. No normal vampire would have chosen a hotel like the Marriott. There were too many windows, and the ones in their room all faced the east where the sun would rise. And Margaret said that her power, like her father's, came from the sun. Unbidden, I remembered walking at night once with Stefan, a friend who was a vampire. At one point he stopped, looked up at the moon, and said, totally out of the blue, I miss the sun, and the last word sounded as though it had been dragged up from the depths of his being. If someone asked Stefan what he would wish for, I think that the ability to walk in sunlight would be very high on that list. Could Thomas walk in the sun? As soon as I thought that, terror screamed up my backbone. Vampires are evil. Even though I like some of them, I know that they are evil. Symbols of faith can work against them, repel them, and cause them pain. Wood works against vampires because it was something that once was living that became dead, sympathetic magic of a sort. But it is sunshine that is the real weapon against vampires. Mercy? Margaret said, her voice concerned. That was a secret too dangerous for anyone to have. They would hunt him down. Which they? All of they. Vampires would hunt him down to steal his secret. Everyone else would hunt him down to kill him to get rid of the fear I had coiled in my stomach. Don't ask him, I said, my voice hoarse. This gift from your power, I think I know what it was. Thomas called her Sunshine, I remembered. That's a secret too big for acquaintances, no matter how friendly. When we're friends, we can pretend you told me then. For now, we can say that I have an idea. And I'm going to pretend I'm wrong, because that would make Thomas the scariest vampire I've ever heard of. We drove for a few miles in silence. Then she said, Thomas isn't a monster, though he disagree with me on that. I don't know how he managed it with his father, who was the single coldest being I have ever known, but he's a good man. I nodded, though I wasn't as sure of it as she was. I cleared my throat. So the third thing you gave him was your blood. It sealed the bargain, she said. That's what my father said. For the next 17 years I always knew where he was, whether he was, well, not happy. Thomas doesn't do happy very much. But he was content, or if he was unhappy or cold or whatever. He says that he did not feel the same connection, not the same way. That's backward to the way a vampire's feeding usually works, I said. I knew that because apparently my Stefan felt that way about me. He knew when I was sad or hurt. He'd known when I had nearly died. I knew that because he'd shown up at the hospital and sat with me all through the night. I'd been pretty high on pain meds, but Adam had told me that Stefan hadn't said a word the whole time. Margaret nodded.
Backward, yes. That's what my father said. Then he said he thought it was the thing that Thomas gave me back for my gifts. Thomas was raised to be a guardian, to protect his father's interests. When his father betrayed him, he still guarded, but he no longer believed in what he was doing. He gave me himself, everything of what he was, when we sealed the bargain with blood.
Voice tight, she said. My father said that the vampire usually takes ownership of those he feeds from, but Thomas reversed that in an effort to balance our bargain. I hesitated, not wanting to be offensive.
Messed up, she said.
I know. If I think of it as a gift of service, it helps.
But I used him, and now we're so lopsided. It's like he thinks of himself as my devoted...
Slave, I suggested. Servant? She laughed, wiping tears from her eyes again.
Can you imagine Thomas as a slave? He'd have the person who thought he was his master committing suicide in an hour, all the while helping out with solicitous advice on the proper length of blade. And even as the knife slid in, the master would think it was all his own idea.
Guard dog, I said.
Yes, she said. That one. It's as if he sees me as this fragile thing to be protected.
She paused.
That's not quite right. It's not as though he doesn't respect me, respect my power, but he sees me as different from him, separate.
She sighed.
I hoped you could help me.
I thought about it. Sometimes simple is best when dealing with men. It's not that they are simple. Simple and Adam didn't belong in the same room. But dealing with them, that was simple.
So seduce him, I said.
I'd love to, she all but wailed. But how?
Okay, seducing Adam wasn't exactly difficult. It was fun, actually, just how much I could get him to react with subtle cues. A nudge. He did it back to me, too, with interest. But Thomas was more like Charles. Thomas needed a sledgehammer first.
Victoria's Secret, I said.
No, that's too feminine. Too much what women think is sexy. I tried to channel Adam.
Have you looked at me? She said. I am covered with scars, and I'm too skinny. I have no muscle. I'm ugly.
I wasn't a guy, so I knew better than to argue with that last statement. What I thought didn't matter. What she thought mattered.
Thomas doesn't think you're ugly, I told her. No one who watches him watch you, no one who saw his face when he picked you up back there in that hotel would ever, ever be under that impression.
I've tried lingerie, she said after a moment.
Big guns are required, I said. Subtle won't work.
Naked.
But I don't have big guns, she said.
Then she dropped her head in her hands.
I can't believe I just said that. I can't believe I said that to someone I just met.
Thomas will like your guns just fine, I assured her. Just ask him. Her jaw dropped open. Then she closed it and laughed. We talked a while more. I offered improbable suggestions, and she responded in kind. Just outside of Pasco, she fell asleep. It had been a long time since I'd talked with a woman who was just my friend. I'd called Char, my old college roommate, over Christmas. Maybe it was time to call her again. I parked the Subaru, and before I had the engine off, Thomas had the passenger door open. When he saw Margaret asleep, he extracted her from the seat without waking her up.
Yep, I thought with satisfaction. He's a goner.
I got out of the car, locked it with the appropriate button on the key fob, and handed the keys to Thomas. He took them, looked at me, then glanced over his shoulder at Adam, who was standing beside the black SUV in the parade rest position that he habitually fell into when waiting for someone. Z had the hood of the SUV up and was tinkering. I frowned at Z. There was nothing wrong with the SUV. I kept all of our cars in excellent running condition.
You should come visit us in San Francisco, Thomas said, his voice quiet. I would be delighted to serve as your escort.
Then he smiled, a real smile. He didn't have Adam's dimples, but it was a good smile anyway,
in the purely tourist sense of the word.
We'll do that, I said. Margaret and I had fun.
Margaret opened her eyes and in a sleepy voice said, Take care, Mercy, and thank you. I hope not to need the big guns.
I laughed. I think you'll find that your guns are plenty. Safe travels.
Thomas turned and headed for the hotel entrance.
I stopped to the SUV and said, There is nothing wrong with the SUV.
Z kept tinkering.
I stood on my tiptoes to see what he was doing. Is there?
Z removed himself from under the hood and held up a small device.
Not anymore. Someone's been tracking you.
Adam held his hand out, looked at the device, and snorted. He passed it to me. It bore a neat label with the SUV maker's logo on it. I'd never had to do anything more complicated than an oil change on the SUV. If I'd noticed the little box, I'd have assumed it belonged.
Feds, I bet, Adam said. We are persons of interest.
How did you find it? I asked C.
Nothing you could do, Liebling, he said. I felt it transmit. It didn't bother me much, but since we had a moment here, I thought I'd take a look.
Adam stuck it under the bumper of the Chevy parked next to the SUV. The Chevy bore all the signs of a rental vehicle, including a license plate surround that advertised for Enterprise. I patted its trunk. May someone rent you for a very long drive to Alaska, I told it. Adam snorted, then asked Z,
Could you tell how long it has been there?
Z nodded.
6 months, maybe a bit more. Someone wants to keep tabs on you, Adam.
This time it was my turn to snort. If I'd known it was there, we could have done something more interesting, like drive out to the middle of the Hanford Reach every full moon and park for the night, which we did, mostly. We had other hunting spots, but the Reach was the best. Sorry I didn't find it, Adam. I'll keep a better eye out next time.
No worries, said Adam softly. I'll have a talk with a few people I know about boundaries that shouldn't be crossed. It won't happen again.
We arrived home to find every door and window in the house open, and the smell of burning wool in the air.
Hey, boss,
said Warren as we came through the doorway, his expression somewhere between pained and amused.
We had a little mishap. Aiden was sleeping when his blankets burst into flame. Happily, Mary Jo was here. While we were all trying to figure out what to do, besides hold our ears to try to shut out the fire alarm, she grabbed the fire extinguisher from the garage and put the fire out. Mattress is a goner, but the room's okay. We have the situation under control.
About that time, Mary Jo came up the stairs, carrying an armful of sodden, blackened fabric that had at one time been a Pendleton wool blanket. She looked at me and said, Life is never boring around here. Then she grinned at me, an expression she hadn't turned on me in a very long while. Your fire demon says that he needs to leave. We convinced him that it would be rude to leave before you got back, but I'm not sure we could have kept him here much longer. As she finished speaking, Aiden came up the stairs. His hair was wet, and he was wearing sweats from the packed stores. I made a mental note that we were going to have to get him clothes if he was going to stay here long.
My apologies, he said as soon as he reached the landing.
He didn't look at either of us.
I am not safe to be around. I didn't light fires in my sleep when I was in Underhill, at least not that I know of. I will find somewhere else to sleep tonight. I appreciate the help you have given me thus far.
Why are you planning on leaving? Adam asked.
That made Aiden raise his face briefly.
I have damaged your home.
Adam shrugged.
We house werewolves here, Aiden. I don't think anyone has tried to burn the house down before.
No, I agreed. That was my house. Adam gave me a rueful grimace.
At least you weren't in it. Werewolves can be very destructive. My contractor sends me Christmas cards and most valuable customer presents every year.
And this time the damage was confined to a mattress and some bedding, I told him. That's cheap by werewolf standards.
The mattress might have been all right, Mary Jo said, if Ben hadn't dumped a 5-gallon bucket of water on it. I told him I had it under control with the fire extinguisher, so the mattress isn't really Aiden's fault. She wrinkled her nose. Excuse me, though, I'm going to get rid of this blanket.
Aiden opened his mouth, then shut it again.
No worries, Adam said. We'll just make sure to keep a fire extinguisher around. Until the situation with the Fae stabilizes, we'll have to have 24/7 guards at the house anyway. I'll just make sure that they keep watch for fire, too.
10.
It's not quite the biggest crane in the world, said the Lampson guy to the police officer. He'd introduced himself as Marley. The Pasco police officer, whom I'd seen before but didn't know personally, was Ed Thorson. He was the only police officer left on the scene, because I'd asked him to get rid of as many people as he could. No one is proud like a dominant werewolf in front of an audience. If there were too many people here, we might end up with him jumping, even if he didn't intend to do it in the first place. Above us, nearly 40 stories up, on the top of the Transi-Lift LTL 3000, was one of our werewolves. I couldn't see him. I'm not sure I could have seen him even in the daylight without binoculars, but he'd been seen climbing up it at the end of his shift, and everyone was very sure that he hadn't climbed back down, or jumped. 3 days had passed since we'd confronted the Fae in the hotel meeting room, and we hadn't heard anything from them. We'd had to step down our security because we just didn't have enough people to stay at high alert for very long. Though Adam made sure that there were at least 2 werewolves at our house at any given time, mostly everyone's lives had returned to normal. Even Aiden setting something on fire when he slept felt normal. One of Adam's techie guys was working on rewiring some smoke alarms so that instead of shrieking, they just buzzed a little. Back to normal meant when Adam got called to work after dinner, he left me in charge. So when the police called to tell me that one of our wolves was sitting on the top of the big Lampson crane and they were worried about him jumping, I was the one who got to go fix it. If Daryl, Warren, or George had been our guard wolves, I'd have sent one of them, because I'd exchanged about 4 words with Sherwood Post. Yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am only counted as 4 words, even if they'd been said every time I tried to strike up a conversation with him. But, as luck would have it, Ben and Paul were the watch wolves on duty, neither of whom I could trust not to drive a suicidal werewolf right off the edge, both metaphorically and literally speaking. Sherwood Post had come to us a month ago from the Maroc. He was too quiet, too polite, and missing his left leg. Werewolves heal. They heal broken things, they heal crushed things, and they heal amputated things. But apparently not if witches were involved. About 4 or 5 years ago, there had been a nasty coven of witches in Seattle. Their leader had been killed by the Emerald City Pack. When the pack went to clean out the home of the leader to make sure that there were no nasty magical surprises left behind, they had found, among other things, an emaciated werewolf in a cage. He was missing his leg. He hadn't remembered who he was or where he came from, and neither did any of the packs. He also didn't remember what had happened to his leg. As best anyone could figure out, he'd been brought over from Europe and traded around among various black witches for years, if not decades. Bran took him home, eventually coaxing him back into human shape. When he couldn't do anything that could make Sherwood's leg regrow, yes, that's as bad as it sounds, he sent Sherwood to doctors, who provided a prosthetic for the human form. The wolf just ran on 3 legs. Sherwood took his name from 2 books that happened to be lying on Bran's desk when Bran told him to pick a name. That Bran would read Sherwood Anderson was not surprising. I wasn't sure if I was more amused or horrified that Bran had been reading Emily Post. According to Bran, Sherwood had approached him in January and asked for a transfer to somewhere with a shorter, more congenial winter than Montana. Most places have more congenial winters than Montana, so Bran had a lot of places he could have sent Sherwood, but he sent him to us. When the call came in about Sherwood and the crane, I hadn't been able to get in touch with Adam other than to leave him a voice message. His office wasn't answering either, which meant whatever he was involved in was some security issue with the government contracts he held.
I couldn't feel anything through the pack bonds that suggested Sherwood was about to kill himself. But Bran hadn't been able to tell when my foster father had gone out to commit suicide either. Sherwood felt just as he always did to me. Quiet. I squinted trying to see him, but he was too far up, and it was too dark. I might not have known Officer Thorson, but I liked him. When I explained that all the extra people who'd been there when I arrived were problematical, he'd listened gravely. Then, without arguing, he'd dispersed everyone, until there were just two guys from Lampson, Officer Thorson, and me. Marley continued to talk to the officer about his crane with the enthusiasm of a golf addict describing his new putter.
"So, not the biggest, that mark keeps moving, but it is the largest twin crawler crane in the world and the biggest crane we've ever built, so far anyway."
I hadn't quite worked out if Marley was the night manager who'd summoned the police, or if he was security, the CEO of the company, or someone in between. He wore scruffy jeans, a Western-style button-up shirt, and needed a shave. He also smelled like beer, but I think most of that was coming off his boots, so maybe he'd come over from a bar or party. I did wish he'd shut up about how big the stupid crane was, because I was pretty sure I was going to have to climb it and see if I could talk Sherwood down. I'd seen the crane before. You can't help but see it when you drive across a suspension bridge, which we had not been able to do tonight. There were no estimates about when that bridge would go back in use. They had to figure out how badly it had been damaged first. I didn't know why I felt guilty about that. I didn't turn loose a troll on the city. Still, even without being on the bridge, you could see the crane for a long way. Lamson's Pasco Yard was located in a warehouse district near the railroad. The whole area still showed signs of the army depot it had once been, with long wooden warehouses laid out in orderly patterns. It was haunted. If I looked, and I tried not to, I could see a few ghosts flickering around. There was one dressed in a World War II Army uniform who watched me. I was pretty sure he was one of the rare, self-aware ghosts. If I stared at ghosts for very long, even just the repeaters, they tended to start following me around. This wasn't the first time I'd come out here. There were a couple of junkyards not too far away. But I'd never seen the crane up close and personal before, and it was a lot bigger than it looked from the bridge.
"So Hitachi commissioned it to build nuclear power plants," Marley was saying expansively. "Then along came that tsunami that hit the Fukushima Daiichi plant, and, well, no one is building nuclear power plants in Japan now, are they? So here it sits."
The big crane was part of the Pasco skyline, which admittedly was not much of a skyline compared to Seattle or Spokane. In the daylight, the crane part of it was bright orange with sections of white, and the crawler part, this thing moved with two tank-like treads that were taller than I was, each with its own control booth, was bright Lampson blue. Obviously, no one with a hint of estrogen in their veins had designed the color scheme. In the dark, though, it rose above us, black against the lighter sky. We were standing right next to one of the treads, just beneath the crawler that allowed the humongous structure to move. Above the crawler, the crane rose like the orange, leaning Eiffel Tower of Pasco. If I squinted and used my imagination, I could just barely see that someone was sitting on the end of the boom head, the highest point of the crane.
"We could start it up if you want," said Marley, following my gaze. "But we waited until you came out, because if we start moving it around, he could fall. I don't know how you feel about your people, but we like ours to survive their tenure with us." He squinted up. "So this guy's tenure is going to end as soon as we get him down."
The nameless guy standing next to him, the only one of the four of us standing there to whom I hadn't been introduced, murmured,
"Marley, that's Sherwood Post. He speaks Russian and English without an accent in either language, I'm told. That means when he's on shift, everyone can communicate with everyone else. Let me say it again. Everyone knows what they are supposed to be doing, and his shiftmates say he can move a 300-pound bar of steel all by himself."
Marley made a growly sound.
"So maybe we give him a second chance, but I hate to encourage this behavior. What if he jumps?"
"Then you probably don't have to worry about firing him," I said.
"What I don't get," said Officer Thorson, looking up to the top of the crane and saying it once more with feeling,
What I don't get is how you let him get up there in the first place.
One of my guys saw him start to climb up, the other Lampson guy answered. He went running for help, and by the time they got back, he was most of the way up. He didn't respond when they yelled, but truthfully, it is windy up there. I don't know if he could have heard them.
He frowned, then shook his head.
But he sure as hell should have noticed all the police and the fire trucks with their sirens and lights.
Yep, it had been a real circus when I got here.
How much can you drop that arm down? Thorson asked.
All the way to the ground, Marley said. We'd have already done it, but it doesn't happen instantaneously, and if he wanted to jump off and kill himself, he'd have plenty of time to do it. Seemed to me that we'd be putting pressure on him to do that very thing.
How high is that? Thorson asked.
Marley smiled like a proud father.
She's 560 feet tall, and she can lift 6 million pounds. 6 million.
He shook his head.
I don't know how he managed to climb all the way up there with one leg. That boom isn't exactly equipped with a ladder.
He's a werewolf, I groused. They are hardwired to do dumb stuff. Maybe I wasn't being fair to Sherwood, whom I didn't know well. But since it looked like I was going to have to follow him up there, I was entitled to be judgmental. I bent down to make sure my shoes were tied. I didn't want to have to tie them while 560 feet in the air, though I suppose since the boom wasn't at a 90-degree angle, more like a 65, it wouldn't really be that high. Probably only like 400 or something. My long-ago unlamented geometry class was too far in the past to be of much help. I straightened up and started for the crane.
What are you doing? Marley asked in the tone of someone used to getting answers. Stop!
But I didn't work for him. Someone's got to talk him down, and he didn't bring his cell phone, I told him, and hopped the chain that blocked off the metal stairway on the side of the crawler. Once I started moving, I moved fast. I was up and on top of the two-story tall crawler before they'd considered doing anything but talking. By then it was too late to stop me because they were human, and no one who was just human could catch me unless I wanted them to. I heard Marley swear, but it didn't feel like he was emotionally involved. His voice had a frustrated sound rather than honest anger. He wasn't coming after me. The boom was built of scaffolding-like bars that crossed and crisscrossed the heavy outer beams that were the corner supports of the boom. Everything was size huge. There was a catwalk along the left edge of the boom that ran all the way to the top. It would have been easy to use if the boom had been flat. As it was, I was forced to scale the thing, clinging to the top rail like Batman in the old 60s TV series. I don't have a problem with heights, generally speaking. But, I decided, clinging to my perch and fighting an attack of vertigo, when cars started to look like they belonged in a matchbox set, that was too freaking high. No more looking down. Jaw clenched and sweating. As soon as the dizziness subsided, I climbed and climbed some more. My shoulders and arms ached, but my hands took the worst of it. I wished I'd brought a pair of driving gloves. My palms grew blisters that burst. My fingers were sore from grabbing the rail.
"What do you think you're doing?" said a man's voice.
He sounded pretty close, and it startled me. I froze, then wrapped myself around the bar I was climbing on before I looked up. Just a car length from me, Sherwood sat on the last, highest rung of the boom, his leg and prosthetic both dangling off the side. He wasn't holding on. Reflexively, I looked down before I remembered how bad an idea it was. I put my forehead against the cool metal and swallowed until I knew I wasn't going to throw up. I looked up at him again. His words had been pretty aggressive, especially for a wolf addressing his alpha's mate, but the tone was soft and relaxed. I answered the tone, not the words. "I'm climbing up after you," I told him. He turned around, balanced on his rump until he could get all the way around, so he could see me easily. I was going to take a wild guess that the height didn't bother him at all. Bastard.
"That's dumb," he said. "Where's one of the werewolves? If they fall, they might be able to catch themselves. What's Adam thinking to send you up here?"
I growled at him. "Adam is otherwise occupied. Next time you decide to kill yourself, wait until he's home and can climb up here himself. If I have to do this again, I might just push you off myself." It probably wasn't what I should have said to someone sitting 500 feet, more or less, in the air, but my hands hurt, and I had made it up here by concentrating on how mad I was at the stupid werewolf who made me do it. Also, I have a problem with suicide, and have ever since my foster father had left me alone at 14 because he couldn't bear to live without his wife. I couldn't take my anger out at him, so I let Sherwood be the scapegoat. He laughed. And yes, I agree with you, I said. Climbing up here is very, very dumb. I know why I did it. Why did you? He sighed and spun around again, making me cling more tightly to my bar.
I'm a useless freak, he said, gesturing at his leg. It's hard to kill a werewolf, but I'm pretty sure that drop would do it.
Me too, but that wasn't a productive thing to say, so I found something else. Marley was going to fire you for climbing up here until the other Lampson guy told him who you were. Apparently, you are too useful to them to fire.
He snorted, and I had a thought. He'd been working here since the third day he'd come to the Tri-Cities.
Just how many times have you climbed up here without getting caught? I asked.
All of them but one, he said.
You came here to get out from under Brand's eyes so you could kill yourself, I said. He didn't say anything, which was a yes in my book.
I thought of the kind of courage it would take to climb all the way up here to kill yourself, decide not to, and climb all the way down nearly every day for the better part of the month. And the question that occurred to me then wasn't why, but why not?
What stopped you? I asked his back.
He raised his head and looked up, gesturing to the night sky with one hand, waving with what I considered to be reckless abandon.
Look at that. Do you see the lights and the sky? Beautiful. Up here, it feels like the huge tightness in my spine that contains all those things I've forgotten loosens up a little.
He tapped his forehead.
I can feel those things curled up inside me, waiting like the Sword of Damocles. And I think, maybe I should wait and see if I can find myself. Then I'll have a better idea of what I have to lose.
I made sure my grip was tight. Then I looked out, not down. And he was right. It was beautiful.
And the wind decided right then to blow hard enough to send a buzz through the rail I was holding on to. I felt the vibrations of it under my fingers, and had to reassure myself that this crane had been sitting here for at least a couple of years and hadn't fallen down yet. It was certainly designed to hold up more than the 300 or 400 pounds that Sherwood and I represented between us, surely. And still, the metal vibrated.
I see your point, I said tightly. But I think your hiding place has been found out. You think maybe we could talk with our feet on the ground? Fair warning, if I fall and break every bone in my body, Adam will never forgive you.
He laughed again.
Okay, he said. Do you need any help getting down?
About halfway to the ground, I stopped to rest. He was below me. When I told him I'd get down the same way I got up, he'd scrambled around me to get underneath where he could catch me if I fell. He hadn't said it, but he hadn't had to. After a minute, I said, "You know what makes me crabby? I didn't need to go up there, did I? If we'd waited for you, you'd have come down just like you always have."
"Yes," said Sherwood. Then he said, his voice a little dreamy, "Probably, but maybe I'd have come down another way."
He started down again then, moving slower than he had to so that I didn't hurry.
You missed your chance, I told him. I think your days of climbing up here unseen are over.
Yes, he said, but there's always a suspension bridge.
If I have to climb up the suspension bridge, I told him, I really will push you off.
He must not have understood I was serious, because he laughed again.
So neither of us got arrested for trespassing, though it was, I understand, a near thing. I got Sherwood into Adam's SUV. The Vanagon's radiator had developed a leak, and I hadn't found it yet, so Adam had taken a Hauptmann security SUV and left me his. I had to think a bit to get the lights on in the SUV in gear, but I remembered not to swerve to avoid the ghost of the guard who stepped into the road in front of us. But I couldn't help but mutter, "Sorry, sorry," under my breath when the bumper went through him. Sherwood looked at me and raised a brow in query.
"Ghosts," I said.
I see dead people.
Do you?
He said.
I nodded. Sucks to be you, he said.
Beats climbing 560 feet up a crane trying to talk down an idiot who couldn't avoid being seen.
True,